Okay, welcome back to the Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Barnabaugh, and I'm joined with Chris Durham here tonight. Chris?
Absolutely. Hey, guys. How's it going?
Yes, we're back after, about a month hiatus? We did our Christmas episode.
Resting on our laurels.
Well, I don't know we were resting on our laurels. We just weren't podcasting. We had a lot of stuff going on, but we've been sort of coming back into the podcast, really trying to plan it out. We have a lot of good stuff we want to bring you this year. 2016 was a crazy year in general. I think everybody agrees. It was a pretty 2016 was a pretty good year for horror movies.
Yeah, much better than I anticipated.
Yes,
going into it,
I thought 2016 was a really good year for genre movies in general. We are going to go back and kind of just wrap up 2016. We hope to do this earlier, but honestly, you and I, Chris, we're kind of trying to catch up those last couple movies.
Yep.
To see,
we and there were the a couple of gems.
Yeah,
this,
yeah, you know? Yeah. We did.
Never let anyone say we're slouches.
So tonight's top 10 horror movies of the year of 2016. The thing I love about doing these lists is that hope that maybe you can turn somebody on to something that they haven't heard of or they haven't seen. I mean, yeah. I still try to be fair to, hey, what did I think the best movies of the year were? But I do also try to put a spotlight on movies that, hey, were recommended to me. I kind of found them almost by accident. And there was a lot of that stuff this year. I think 2016 had a lot of movies like that. 2017 looks like it's going to have a good number of movies that have that potential, I think, to slip under the radar. Smaller stuff that we find on Netflix or
something that's great about the horror genre and a lot of other movies now. A lot of these movies I would not have seen had I not stumbled across them on Netflix. Like, a lot of great content is being put out there on Netflix now.
I agree. And the quality here stems across big mainstream releases and small releases. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot here. I think the cool thing about this, I'm looking over my list. I don't know about your list, Chris, but my list, I don't think there's a single title on here that you can't get via streaming right now or is available on DVD or something like that. Like almost every one of my
options,
you're
absolutely right. Yeah.
You can go out right now and see on the horror list. So without further ado, why don't we just jump right in?
Love it. Let's do it.
What I think we could do, we'll start with number 10, we'll go to number 1, and then we can kind of circle back and just cover a couple of our honorable mentions. Because I don't know about you, but because the year was so rich, there are several movies that in a different year probably would have been much higher. There was movies that last year would have probably been in my top 5 that aren't even on this list because of the quality that we have here. So we'll kind of circle back and at the very end do some honorable mentions, and maybe we can even take a stab at a couple of worst movies of the year, the worst horror, because there's a couple of, I have a
real
bone to pick with a couple. So, Chris, do you want to lead us off with your number 10 movie?
Sure, and this one actually, I have one here primarily because it does one thing and it does it very well. The jump scare, it's a pretty common theme in movies where you have something just kind of pop out at you and you go, that was terrifying. But it's these days it's been so common, especially for the genre people, like you watch enough movies, the jump scare's effectiveness tends to wane over time.
It becomes abused.
You become just waiting for that moment to pop out. You can kind of see it develop. This movie, Lights Out, that came out during the summertime, did the jump scare, and it did it really, really well. Like, it was a movie of nothing but jump scare moments, and they were all finely crafted and, like, left you panting at the end. You're just going, it was great. So this movie involves sort of a creature in the darkness jumping out at you, but when the lights are on, you can't see it. So there's a lot of great light, dark moments that kind of flip-flopped, and you never knew when it was going to kind of jump out at you. And I thought it did it very effectively.
Yeah, Lights Out, first off, that concept is such a creepy one. Because as a kid, you sit there in the dark, or maybe as a scared adult, in the dark, and you imagine you're seeing something. There's that thing in the corner. But when I turn the lights on, I know I can expect that it's going to just be the side of the bed with some clothes hung over it.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of Lights Out is the monster really is there. When you turn the lights on, it's not there, but that's not the comfort, because as soon as the lights go back off, it's closer than it was before. And it almost felt like a take on those the characters from the Doctor Who TV show, the Weeping Angels, where there's a stone statue, but when you turn around, that stone statue is going to advance on you, but you won't ever know it, because by the time you turn around, it'll either be a statue again, or it's got you.
Yeah.
And that was such a simple premise, and it was a premise in the original short film the same director made, which is really effective too. In fact, I was sitting there thinking, how can they, and I don't know that they improve on it, but I was, how can you take this short film, which is very concise and very creepy, and gets its point across totally. There doesn't need to be any more. No. So the fact that they took this and turned it into a 90-minute movie that's pretty effective was good. And you're right. It's kind of stripped down to just...
bare essentials.
Yes. The jump scares are effective. But you know what else I thought was effective? And recently you and I were talking about, what does it take to make a good horror movie? And I think everyone's going to figure it out for themselves. What are the elements I want in a good horror movie? And for me, I was thinking about it, and it's like, you need to have a creepy premise. Mm-hmm. You need to have good, strong characters. And then I think you also need to have a something in there that is legitimately scary. Like a legitimate story that drives you forward and terrifies you in some way. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't terrify you, it can be a really good whatever movie, but it's hard to really think of that movie as a horror film.
Yeah.
And so this movie had a creepy premise. The premise works. It has good characters, which is surprising because you kind of start the story and these characters, they feel a little bit like cutouts. Teresa Palmer's girl who her mother is dealing with mental illness, and so she's kind of estranged from her. Mm-hmm. But they add some nice little tweaks to her character that make her interesting. She has everybody at a distance because she doesn't want to get close to them. A character that surprised me was the boyfriend. He was a complete throwaway character.
Yes.
And then he kind of emerges as a kind of fan favorite towards the middle of the movie. Yeah. You are kind of rooting for him. And they really play with the premise a lot. Like, they have lots of fun with, well, how can we dispel the monster with the flashlights and the... I don't even want to talk
about
it.
Fairly inventive.
Yeah. It didn't quite make my list. This is one of those cases where in a year like this, there were so many movies. But I thought, for what it was very effective. And I jumped and I thought there were legitimate scares in the movie.
Yeah, I thought it was all...
I highly recommend that.
Good. I agree, though. I feel if I had seen a few more horror movies this year, maybe it would not be on this list. But I thought, for what it was so effective at that. That being one of the base pillars of horror is the jump scare.
Great monster, too. Love
creepy,
the monster.
Creepy, cool monster. Yeah, everything about it was kind of neat. So that's number 10 for me.
Yeah, last thing I'll say about Lights Out, I feel like it was a vindication of a movie. Several years back, there was a movie called... Darkness Falls. I was so... I saw the trailer and it had that similar sort of premise and I was so excited to see it. And I remember going to see it with my then girlfriend at the time, now my wife, and we were both so disappointed by it. And it had taken that premise and just ruined it, and it was nice to see someone take the same idea and show that it can work. So
I just like to see the flip side of that, where now we have a Tooth Fairy movie that's actually scary. That would be nice for once.
Well, we kind of do. I guess it's sort of a spoiler to say, but Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. It's kind of a Tooth Fairy movie.
You know what? You're absolutely right about that. Yeah, I didn't even think of that.
So you feel better about the Tooth Fairy now. So my number 10 is a movie that when I initially saw it, it was interesting to me. I found it suspenseful. I thought it had good characters and a good premise. When I finished it, I was like, that was good. That was effective. And then I kind of went on. But over time, it just stuck with me. And I kept thinking about it at times. And I haven't actually... I watched it one time. And a lot of its ideas, a lot of its scenes have just stuck with me and kind of haunted me, which I think is a good sign of a horror movie.
Absolutely.
And this was a movie that came... We have a lot of movies this past year, in 2016, that dealt with the concept of paranoia and fear and suspicion, which was also very prominent in the news, in the general social culture.
Very prominent
and
this year.
This particular movie, I think, picks at that membrane in a way that's thoughtful. So my number 10 is a movie by Karen Kusama called The Invitation.
Yes.
Very small movie. We actually discussed it on, I think, our second episode of the podcast, the one that you and I did, where we talked about paranoid horror films. Mm-hmm. And I saw this movie, it was early last year, and it's such a great example of using small resources and really getting into the heads of your characters to create something that's very suspenseful.
Yeah.
And so the basic premise is awesome because it's a dinner party horror movie. And you don't see many of those. I can only really think of The Exterminating Angel, the Louis Bonnell movie, is probably a dinner party that's about on par with this one. But there's an element of the mundane, and then creepy dread gets in there because you have this couple who is now separated because of a tragedy. Mm-hmm. And the wife has gone on to get remarried. And they invite all of their old friends, including the ex-husband, over for dinner. And everyone's there. And they're primarily there to kind of support and be there for this woman. But when they get there, they realize that there's sort of a secondary reason they've been invited. It's not really to kind of clear the air and just reconnect.
Wait, that's right. They were trying to sell Tupperware.
Yes, yeah. It turns out it's actually a, what do you call it? What's that? Amway.
I was going to say that.
Right. It turns out they've all been invited over to participate in Amway. That actually happened to Jen and I. We had this couple that invited us over for dinner, and they were talking, and they're like, oh, we're going to talk about business. And I didn't even know what they wanted. So we went over, and we had this great evening. They give us this nice dinner. We're talking to them. And then they spring this Amway thing on them, and I'm like, this seems like a pyramid scheme. And they're like, but it's not. I was like, but it's just an upside-down pyramid. Yeah. And so what's happening in Invitation is a little more sinister than Amway.
Yes.
But you don't know that going in. And the movie keeps balancing between what we think is happening.
Yes, and it does it
might
so
not
well.
Be happening. Yeah, so it takes the themes that you would associate with Hitchcock, but it doesn't. I wouldn't say it has Hitchcock style. It takes
a different
path.
It doesn't have his fingerprints.
No, this has more the fingerprints of like a really well-done stage play.
Yes, yes.
There are no shots that call attention to themselves, although I think the directing is very strong. There's one haunting scene at the very end. But I'd say that this movie, it builds to a crescendo, but the crescendo, the kind of climax of the film, while exciting in its own way, isn't what grabs me. It's all those little paths to get there. Mm-hmm. This has got some fantastic acting, and particularly there's a great bit by John Carroll Lynch. John Carroll Lynch plays this guy who shows up halfway through the movie, this guy named Pruitt, and he kind of takes all those accumulating elements of creepiness and hones them in, and it just becomes like a little ember of unease. But there's a lot of stuff going on in this movie.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head when you talk about an indie film really digging in and getting everything out of its performances. This was just fantastic on that level. Like every little aspect of it was done very, very well and created a very tense film.
Yeah,
so I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's really good, and there's some substance there. There's some stuff to actually think about.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I have for number 9 another sort of smaller movie, but it hit theaters, and I didn't actually get a chance to see this until it came out on Blu-ray. But Green Room, starring the late Anton Yelchin.
Yes, yeah, so sad.
And Patrick Stewart as a leader of a group of neo-Nazis, essentially in a big old bar area where Anton Yelchin and his band are going to perform, and they're kind of like a punk, I don't know if you'd call them straight edge sort of band, but they're very anti like skinhead, anti-Nazi kind of thing, and so they're performing their music, and I guess they play a song that's a little bit too politically motivated and kind of gets all the patrons of the bar against them. So they get stuck in the back room, and tensions start building. They observe a crime happen, and basically from then on out, it's a fight for survival to escape. And I thought that this movie was very well done because it just takes that simple premise, and it goes to very sinister heights with it. But at the same time, it's like a fight for survival. You're really rooting for them, but like all these, it's also very dark, and the things that happen are legitimately horrifying. Typically, I'm not a big fan of that kind of movie, or I wouldn't call this like a home invasion movie, but it has a very similar feel to it. People are just trying to escape a place where they're basically trying to kill them. You know, I think for that sort of film, this was done pretty well. You got some strong performances. I'd never thought Patrick Stewart would be effective as like a leader of a group of skinheads, but I think he pulls it
like
off pretty well.
Like a backwoods neo-Nazi.
Yeah, like a... Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's very simple. But what it has to offer, I think, is a good film. What do you think about that one, Nathan?
You know, and you said this isn't really my kind of horror, and I kind of agree. I saw Green Room again early in the year, a little bit before it was released in the general public, and when I saw it, it's kind of that survival horror. You know, you talk about like Home Invasion, and I think it is like that survival horror where someone is, or a group of someone's, is trapped in a specific area and they have to fight their way out. And there's really no other way but forward through the enemy, so to speak.
Literally through the enemy.
This isn't a movie where you can run away. This isn't a movie where you can just run across the field and escape. This is like Aliens. This is like Zulu. This is like any movie where you've got people trapped, they're hemmed in, and they're going to have to draw on external and internal resources to get out of it.
Yeah.
And The thing that sets the Green Room kind of apart from a lot of those movies, it's just its depth of realism, I think. Now, I say realism, not everything in this movie, I think, has a feel of like, oh, I can see how that could happen. But there's this plausibility of like, this whole situation could come about. This could be a headline. Yeah. And the movie never tips into anything, not just supernatural, but it also just doesn't go over the top in its action. This is not Die Hard we're talking about. We have this group of, and they capture all the little details. This is a movie directed by Jeremy Saulnier, who did Blue Ruin, which was another really good, melancholy kind of horror film that didn't feel like your typical horror film in the sense that it exists in a very... That was a little more
reflective.
Like, yeah, internally, I think Green Room is not a reflective movie.
No.
And yet, that's kind of where its strength lies. A movie... I've saw Green Room one time, and one time is really enough for me. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that because it wasn't effective. It's very effective. It's almost too effective in that way. I don't want to relive that experience.
There are pretty gruesome moments in it.
But... Yeah, Roger Ebert had written a review once walking out of Aliens where he said, I can applaud this movie for what it did because how effective it is, but I just walked out feeling bad. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I just felt unsettled. Now, strangely enough, I don't feel that way about Aliens. I actually think Aliens is a fun ride. It exhilarates me. Green Room has exhilarating elements, but it's so brutal. It's so rough, and it's kind of tragic in a sense. But the realism, even from the beginning with this band where they have to siphon the gas out to get, you know, they're getting from one gig to the next. And Anton Yelchin, he's so good in this. He really... takes a character and makes him seem plausible and realistic without ever alerting you to the fact that he's acting. Mm-hmm. You know, he just seems very natural. He also seems very natural as the movie progresses and he has to do things that don't really seem like the laid-back punk kid that he is. But when they go to that bar and the little details, so they get up there and they decide to play the song, and it's a you know,
anti-Nazi
song, and the way the Nazi guys respond, but like once the violence hits, it becomes almost you want to turn away from it a little bit, but it's not even I don't feel that it's that explicit. It's explicit, but it's not gratuitous. Mm-hmm. Violence happens, and then
what happens suits what happens. Like, it suits the film very well.
And it's so intense. It's like a sledgehammer over your head. And to me, is
the tone of the band. Like,
it's right. And you're right. The movie itself has a very punk feel. If you're into the punk scene, you may want to see this, even if you don't really like horror, because it kind of embraces that punk mentality. Mm-hmm. And Patrick Stewart, you're right, he's great in it. But the movie never feels a need to expand and give him some big grandstanding acting scene. It never needs to expand and become this drama, heartfelt. There's no time for that. There's no breath for that. It just keeps moving, like, from one thing to the next. It reminds me of Deliverance in that way, where it's a heck of a ride, but when you're done, you're just kind of, you're done.
Yeah.
You're sort of exhausted from it. But I think it's not my kind of horror movie, but it was good.
What was your number 9, Nathan?
So my number 9 is a movie that's in a lot of ways similar, and I kind of went back and forth about between Green Room and this movie. This is another movie that takes a premise that it exists in the real world, that could easily be a headline ripped out, and creates another kind of cat and mouse game where you've got two groups. You've got your protagonist and you got your antagonist, and it eschews supernatural again so that the playing field is a little bit even. You kind of feel that these characters on either side of the fence aren't going to be able to do anything superhuman to get themselves out of a situation, which I think increases the horror. This was Fede Alvarez's Don't Breathe,
which we saw
over the summer in August, and I saw Evil Dead. There were things I liked about it, but to me it didn't come off... I didn't fully enjoy it as a movie. Mm-hmm. I thought... I could see him cutting his teeth on some cool ideas, but he didn't seem to deliver a story to me. So Don't Breathe, I think he comes into his own here. He's got a pretty interesting story to work with. You've got this house in the middle of like the rundown slums of Detroit. There's very few people around. You've got these young people who come in to rob this house. Mm-hmm. They find out, they know beforehand that it's a house of a blind man, and they think that's going to make it easier. But he's this blind war vet, played by Stephen Lang, in this really crazy, muscular performance that just, when they get into the house, he becomes aware of them and he flips off the lights, and then it becomes this, it then, you know, the tone of the movie becomes something like Lights Out, where the monster, quote unquote, is stalking them through this house. But this monster also happens to be a man who has his own story and his own character foibles to deal with, and the movie deals with them. And I really like this a lot. I will say, Jane Levy is excellent. She was also in Evil Dead remake, and she's really good here. Everyone's good. The middle sequence, when they're in the house, is fantastic. It's probably some of the strongest, just visceral movie most making of the stuff, whole year, of any kind of movie. Like, it's so visceral. And the house itself becomes almost like a character because you're in the dark half the time. You don't even know where you're at. You're learning with them where things are, the geography of this house. It's not a big gothic mansion. It's a plausible home. And you're finding your way through it. That's what
makes it so great, because they don't know anything about it. And at any given point, he could just pop up.
Like Green Room, you are right there with the protagonist. Yes. Most of the time, you don't know any more than they know. Mm-hmm. And that, sometimes in horror movies, can be kind of smug. And horror movie viewers, we sit there and we say, oh, the killer's right around the corner. Yeah. You're in for it. Don't Breathe in Green Room take us out of that kind of lofty, view it from a distance feel and put us right down there. We don't know anymore.
Oh, yeah, we're in the trenches.
And it's helpful because those movies have a feeling of originality. We don't, anything could really happen. Mm-hmm. That being said, for me, Don't Breathe loses a little bit when it goes, it kind of moves into its third act because without going, I understand why they made some of the choices they make, but the story goes in some places that to me kind of, They take away some of the intensity. They sort of,
it definitely
ramp
changes
it down.
We
get in some tone. Kind of really kind of icky and strange plot twists. It's not so much that I had a problem with them, but they definitely move the movie into a new sort of element.
It into a new light, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And so you're sitting there being a little bit more disturbed in a different way. And it actually de-escalates some of the like pure tension that they had. And so to me, the reason this movie isn't higher on this list, probably much higher, is because of that one element. But I'd still say, if you're a fan of this kind of suspense, this is like reverse Home Invasion, where the characters breaking in are the ones who become the victims. But it's good stuff.
Plenty of fun to have there.
Yes, yeah.
Cool. Well, for my eighth movie, I chose a Polish movie. We watched last weekend called Demon. And the thing that makes this one really interesting is I wouldn't out and out call this necessarily a horror movie. It has a few horror elements to it, but it's more about the relationship of people to the Polish people to their like Jewish counterparts and their history there and how they relate to one another. And like back in World War II, when things were going on, I mean, you had just the normal Polish people taking over the Jewish homes and synagogues and stuff and just killing them, burying them in the backyard in some cases. This is a movie dealing with a Dybbuk, which is a Jewish spirit that hasn't moved on yet and will possess a human host so that it can do what it wanted to do in life or was promised. The thing that makes this movie interesting to me is it kind of starts off with a guy, I believe a dude from London, going to marry this woman in Poland, and the family estate, it's kind of like a broken down home, and they have like a digger there so they can dig a pool, I believe is what they want to do. And so they decide to have the marriage there in like the next couple of days. So the guy's trying to get the house a little bit more in order before they have this wedding, and he comes across a skeleton in the backyard. And from there, the movie takes a total kind of different turn, and the wedding goes on, and it's really just madness of like crazy things happening and how human people themselves, when they do enough drinking, kind of become demons in a way. I mean, that's a kind of silly thing to say, but it's a lot about human nature and a lot about the demons of the past. And I mean, even in America, we have obviously we have our own demons. We have the slavery and things like that we deal with. So we have things that aren't exactly too far removed from this that, affect us. But I thought it was a very interesting movie. I thought it was very heartfelt. I felt that it wasn't exactly terrifying, but it was fascinating to watch. What did you think about the movie, Nathan?
I struggle with this, not on the qualities of whether it's a good film, but on where to place it. And so ultimately for me, this one, when I was considering it all, I ended up considering it for the other list, our fantasy and science fiction list. One of the reasons for that is this really is an excellent movie. Mm-hmm. I agree. What I've noted about like people's responses to it, particularly in the horror community, is they come to it kind of expecting a horror film, and seemed to be let just down. But everything you just said about it is true.
Like the horror of it is all about the human nature. Like, it's all about what we do and relate to other different types of people. I mean,
yeah, it's about the things that, to me, that are truly scary at the end of the day are those things that you can't so easily just walk out of or escape. Like, even in a movie like Don't Breathe, I'm in this tense, horrible situation. But if I get beyond it, I'm out of it and no one can kill me. But Demon is really about the baggage that we carry individually, but then as we also carry as a collective whole, you know, that kind of psychological shadow spots on history that you talk about, that a group of people can't necessarily get away, particularly if you don't own those things. And like you said, there's a weird allegorical sense of the bones in the backyard that nobody wants to talk about. But in Demon, there may literally be bones in the backyard. Yes. But I think that for me, the way the Dybbuk element plays into the film, they go for so long, really allowing you to have an open interpretation of whether there is a Dybbuk and whether there's not. And it develops a kind of magical realist feel where, to me, this film was much more strongly about the characters, but it's so meticulously crafted in a way that almost very few other movies I saw this year were, because it's done so carefully. Everything is so carefully constructed. You were kind of alluding to the fact that there's a lot of different readings to it. There's a lot of different ways in which the tension and the mystery are occurring, because you have those bones in the backyard. You have this young man who doesn't really know this family because he's marrying someone he only really started speaking to a little earlier, and he's never met the family before, and they've never met him, so he's a question mark. Mm-hmm. And they're a question mark. You introduce alcohol, you introduce potential drugs. To set the whole thing at this Polish wedding where there's a lot of pomp and circumstance and ceremony going on, and it's just a fascinating look into a culture and a mythology, the Dybbuk, that I personally don't know a lot about, and Hollywood has never dealt with in a very interesting way. But the decision that are made all the way through by this director, Marcin Rona, who sadly took his life like while this movie was on the festival circuit. He killed himself in a hotel room after one of the screenings of the movie.
It is very talented, clearly,
and really seems to understand some of that, those ideas of like what it is to be this like kind of outsider. And there's a pain of like, what is it when you're carrying something that no one around you necessarily understands? I felt like that was a real element of the story. But this, to me, it kind of transcends what we would think of as this horror movie about this ghost. You know, I can see a Hollywood movie done like this and it being solely focused on what the Dybbuk does at the wedding. And that's really not what this movie is about at all.
No.
And I'm not saying it's not a horror film, but I think that it's what is so great about it sort of transcends that element. But I think this is a really strong movie and people should give it a chance. I would just caution, don't go into this expecting the thrills and the chills. It's not about that. This is about something that's going to stick with you. You're going to be thinking about it. You're going to that like icicle of dread in your mind kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. What do you have there?
So my number eight was Green Room.
Ah,
so you see, I was kind of going back and forth. Again, good movie, very intense, very very different than Demon. So my number eight was Green Room. What's your number eight?
Cool. That was Demon.
Oh, yeah, sorry, you're number seven.
That's right. Though the number seven, this is going to be funny, The Invitation. We just discussed that. You know, I really enjoyed The Invitation, especially the character Pruitt, because he just was just the creepiest guy. As soon as you saw him, you knew something was off about him, but you couldn't put your finger on it because he was so normal, but also not, like, he just had this off-putting aura. It was fantastic, but overall, I think that Invitation was fantastic. That's definitely on my top 10 as number seven.
And that's available. I think most of the movies we talked about are actually available either on Netflix or on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And, or in case of Don't Breathe, you can rent it from Redbox. And I think you can also, you could pay to rent it from Amazon. But The Invitation's on Netflix. And the last thing I'll say about that, since we've kind of come back on it, is if you give it a chance, do stick with it. Because this is a slow burn movie.
You're right. Yeah,
this is probably more of a slow burn even than any of the other titles. I'd say maybe more so than Demon, because Demon starts laying its cards out right at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, we have all these elements. And Invitation doesn't. You really need to see this entire movie to even get the whole arc of the horror. So my number seven is another movie that in a way is a slow burn horror. It's also another peek into a culture that I don't really know much about, a mythology that I'm not as familiar with. And so to me, that kind of thing is exciting. It makes, I feel like I'm outside that safety walls of the genre elements that I know. You know, sometimes horror can be a comfort food in the sense of, oh, I know I'm going to get this. And in American horror, you kind of have a basic idea of where the boundaries are. Sure. There's going to be the killer. There's going to be the hero. We kind of know what monsters and ghouls exist in American horror and where their mythologies come from. This is a movie that's very different because it kind of changes and kind of resets your perspective because of the cultural difference. This is a movie called Under the Shadow by Baba Anvari. And it's a movie taking place in Tehran. And it's what, in the 1980s? I think early 1980s. So right around the time of revolution. Yeah. And everything is in real upheaval. And this is a story of a woman and her daughter who end up facing a kind of supernatural entity. I don't want to get too much into it because I recommend you watch it. It just came on Netflix. And takes place in this sort of broken down apartment building in Tehran where a bomb has literally fallen into the apartment and is sort of just hanging there.
It's like that Devil's Backbone.
It does. Style. That element reminded me of the Devil's Backbone where you have this bomb and the bomb itself doesn't do anything, but it's this reminder of the dangers from outside. And then the dangers within, someone dies in the apartment complex and then this sort of dark supernatural figure comes in. And the movie then becomes this film where you have this female character who's trying to protect her daughter from this entity, but there's a lot of cultural stuff going on at the same time. I mean,
that's the thing that I found that's very interesting about this movie, because you have this like sort of creature, entity, whatever, but at the same time, something as simple as one of her neighbors finding out that she's got these exercise videos could be equally as dangerous.
Yeah, there's a great scene in the film, this isn't really spoiling anything, where she has to make the decision in order to protect her child to get away from this thing, and she runs outside without her head covering on, and she ends up spending the night in the police station.
Yeah.
And it's that reminder of the consequences. And she, you know, she and her husband have both kind of had the same road, but she, you know, they both were activists growing up, but you know, he has a career and she does not. And there's that tension too with the medical books. You know, she wants this career, and we see how hard that struggle is. But that struggle is also kind of driving a wedge between her instincts to be a mother because of the culture around her. And the monster, the ghost, the creature, whatever you want to call it, is compelling and interesting, but it's kind of secondary to the characters in this one. Yes. This is another movie like Demon where the character work is what draws me in and what engages me.
Strong.
The movie's spooky. I thought it was very creepy in places. It's not a full-tilt horror movie, but I really liked it a lot. It felt like a good companion piece to a movie like The Babadook.
Yeah.
I think The Babadook is more visceral, but these are two good bookends, and I think it's worth seeing to engage this culture.
I definitely found it fascinating to see things from a different perspective, because like you say, you do get so used to like the American horror tropes and all this kind of stuff. But I definitely have this on my honorable mentions. If I had a list of honorable mentions, it would definitely be on it.
It's good. It's worth your time. It's worth seeing.
So for my number six, moving on to number six now, I have another Netflix special for you. They Look Like People.
Yes,
another movie we talked about on that paranoia episode.
Yes, we did.
And equally worthy to be talked about here because it was so good. It was so creepy. I guess do another little brief synopsis of it. It basically involves a group of friends, two men who haven't really hung out in a while. One has some mental issues or perceived mental issues where he's very paranoid about potentially like a invasion of some demonic force or alien force, like taking over bodies and turning them into creatures. Hence the title of the movie, They Look Like People. And then you have his other friend who's kind of estranged, who took kind of a different path, and he's in the corporate world trying to be successful. And again, this is also a bit of a slow burn because there's not a whole lot of like jump scares, not a lot of moments that are just going to terrify you.
Except I'd say there are no jump scares,
none.
Really.
They build like in a very sinister fashion. The things that I found most terrifying were just like phone calls. Like in the middle of the night, you'll get a phone call, and you can almost feel from his diseased brain in a way, like this voice on the other end, telling him the end is coming and be prepared, and who can he trust, who can he not trust. It's a movie about friendship. It's a movie about not knowing if the person next to you is who they say they are. And it's very, very suspenseful, very scary. There's some of the most chilling stuff in the movie. You don't see anything scary directly. Like, I think at the beginning of the movie, one of the guys is staring at his girlfriend while they're sleeping.
That is an incredibly spooky scene.
And nothing happens, but it's just, so terrifying because you're not sure if...
He's watching the, soft silhouette of his girlfriend. She's turned away from him. It's the middle of the night. He's woken up. And all these things in the world of his mind have come crashing down on him. And he wakes up to see what should be familiar and comforting and a port in a storm. And it's not, because she's a stranger to him, too, because of what's going on in his head.
Yeah.
This movie, I have to admit, it cut right to what scares the crud out of me, which is that idea of losing not just your mind, but your bearings.
Mm-hmm.
And that tenuous kind of partnership we have with other people, that kind of deal we make with the world, that yes, I will try to trust people. How when that membrane falls away, when he stops putting any kind of trust in the people he encounters, in anyone at all, how scary and creepy and lonely that becomes for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the relationship he has with his friend. You said it's a movie about friendship. Really is. This isn't just a movie where two guys are friends. This is about friendship. This is about friendship that extends beyond that terrible distrust. And I think what's fascinating about horror movies is even when there may be a dark outcome, you have movies where people have to kind of rise to the occasion. And I think that's true of most of the movies on our list. People rising to the best of their humanity in remarkably dark circumstances. And They Look Like People is fascinating in that respect, because mm-hmm. I think at the end of the day, that's what you have. You have a movie about how important our human connections are, even though it kind of plants that seed in your head about the mistrust and the paranoia and the creepiness. And it's kind of an apocalypse movie with no apocalypse, in a sense.
Yeah.
And
just is that final really sequence, the guys down in the basement, and they're, it's just, you don't know what's about to happen. And it really is one guy just taking his life in his hands for the sake of friendship. And
this was nerve jangling. This movie had me on edge more than almost anything on this
list. It is very good. And also, surprisingly short. I think it was an hour and 20 minutes, but it sets everything up so well. It sets up its universe so well.
Yeah, this guy, Perry Blackshear, I think,
is very
excellent. I want to see another movie from him.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'd say actually everybody on this list, sadly, Martian Rona, we won't see more from him, but everybody in this list, I'm anxiously waiting their next movie, because mm-hmm. it's funny, because a lot of these guys are relative, and girls, are relative up-and-comers,
mm-hmm.
and most of these movies, they really set the stage to see something good, regardless of what genre they do, so.
I'll agree, no spoilers yet, but one of my guys maybe is not as exciting, but we'll get to that.
For me, number six, I always talk about brand new kind of faces, Dan Trachtenberg, who did 10 Cloverfield Lane, movie that totally surprised me, because while I enjoyed J.J. Abrams' produced Cloverfield,
mm-hmm.
I had no idea what to expect from 10 Cloverfield Lane, which me I either. Love. I love that a trailer a month before the movie released with no idea what was going on. I don't know if we're going to be able to have that same kind of anticipation when the next movie comes out, because we're starting to kind of catch on.
Mm-hmm.
But that hook got you, we're going into a movie and I don't know quite what to expect, because this is a sequel, but it's not. And it's not a sequel, really. It's just a movie that has a overall kind of wrapper. I can see how it's connected in ways to the original Cloverfield, but it's not. And as we got these small pieces, there's people down in a bunker with John Goodman. That's kind of scary, right?
Yeah.
And you've got Goodman and you've got Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and they're in this bunker, and the other guy's there too. And what happens when you're seeing the trailers, you're kind of trying to figure out, well, what's the twist? What's the supernatural element? Mm-hmm. And the movie starts, and you stop caring about that fact.
Yes.
And you're caring solely about what's going on between these three people down in this bunker. And Goodman gives, I honestly think,
terrifying Goodman in this one.
He is. He gives an Oscar-worthy performance. Honestly, I don't think he's going to get an Oscar for this or nominated, but he really should. The acting here, this is excellent. This is
something you've never seen Goodman do before.
this is a great villain. This is like one of the best. I don't even call him a villain because of how the different shades of the character. But we have Cloverfield and we have the giant Cloverfield monster. Goodman is the Cloverfield monster in some senses. Now, that's not a spoiler if you haven't seen the movie, but he just dominates this whole thing. And there,
you know what really reminds me of as we're talking about this? The lady who was in Misery.
Kathy Bates.
I feel like Kathy Bates is a very strong connection.
This is a comparable sort of performance. You're right. In the tone, in the feel of it. But there's a lot of great work that goes into this movie. It kind of, for me, hits all the right buttons when they're down in the bunker and you're trying to figure out what's going on. To me, what's weird is as the movie progresses to the elements that you see in the trailer, the mystery elements that everyone's wondering about, when we finally get those elements revealed to us, it's not so much that they're unsatisfying as they just don't really matter to the story
everything
anymore.
That you've seen up to that point.
Right.
Is
the only
really
thing that keeps Cloverfield, 10 Cloverfield Lane, probably could have been the one of the absolute top two or three movies on this list. But the last half, or not even the last half, but the last third, kind of goes into sort of a different genre. Because I'd say the movie's kind of pretty locked tight in a horror genre for the first two-thirds of the movie. And it sort of jumps elsewhere. And you could probably even guess where it goes. And it wasn't that I didn't enjoy that, but it has this nice, concise Twilight Zone feel before that. Mm-hmm. And it kind of moves out of that. But this is absolutely worth seeing, if for no other reason than for Goodman's performance. But Mary Elizabeth Winstead, she's great too. So
yeah, I really enjoyed that movie. I'm actually kind of surprised it didn't end up in my final 10 because I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, it was good. It was good stuff.
So for moving on to number 5, halfway through the list, I actually have Don't Breathe as my number 5. I really enjoyed that one. I like Fede Alvarez's other movie that let you mention, the Evil Dead remake. I enjoy the old Evil Dead, and I kind of like this one as a separate entity. I would say between the two, Don't Breathe is definitely better. But it's also a very different kind of
with
movie.
This. I think he you see his vision totally. Is primarily what's here.
Yeah.
It's not leaning on Raimi or anything like that. And in talking about how good Goodman was in that movie, Lang is excellent in this one, too. I mean, these are kind of, again, that back-to-back, like, tour de force.
Almost starting to channel that, like, grizzled George C. Scott almost in this. He's, like, becoming an old, leathery man that is just this great grizzled performer.
He's terrifying, but sometimes he's sympathetic, then he's not sympathetic.
Yeah.
You know, he runs the gamut, and he's good at doing that. He can seem frail and wholly imposing at the same time. This is the guy that played that beefed up,
and you know, we have
General in Avatar, but also General Pickett in the Gettysburg movies.
True. I've completely forgot he played Pickett. Yeah, and let's not forget the dog is no slouch either in this movie. It has some great scenes with I don't even remember the name of the dog, but they had a dog in it that was pretty had some terrifying moments.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it went as rough as a dog's in Green Room. But
yeah. What was your halfway point, number 5?
So number 5 for me is a movie that I just saw a couple weeks ago. We just saw a couple weeks ago. Had this recommended to me by a friend, and just wasn't on my radar at all. Wasn't even really aware of it. Saw it on Amazon, but honestly thought that it was basically one of those straight-to-DVD movies that the title doesn't attract you. The cover doesn't attract you. When you become aware of the premise is compelling, but you're still like, I don't know. This movie is The Autopsy of Jane Doe.
That was so good.
And stars Emile Hirsch, Brian Cox. So when I heard these stars, I was like, okay, that sounds good. And the premise is so simple. The police come to a home where there's a bunch of people horribly murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like they murdered each other, possibly. And then there is a dead, naked woman in the basement, halfway submerged in dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And they take this body to the morgue to have it autopsied. And Emile Hirsch and Brian Cox are a father and son team that do this work together in the morgue. And they put her body out and they start to do an autopsy on it. And they start to notice a lot of things that are just really wrong about this. A lot of strange things start to happen. Supernatural sort of elements that are clearly tied to this body they have there. And the interesting thing, too, is that there's a female actress playing this dead body. And there's reasoning behind that as the film progresses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But she's laying there on the slab. She really has Brian Cox breathing over her with his big mitts. I mean, there's clearly some prosthetic work and practical effects work there, too, because you do see the bones splitting, flesh slicing work that goes into autopsying someone, but it's not
exploitative.
It handles it very classy, and it has a very old school horror movie feel. This is this is very contained. Again, I think one of the things I notice about most movies on my list, they are contained to almost like one setting. You've got the wedding, you've got the bunker, you've got the house in Tehran. You know what I mean? Blind man's home. These movies, we're not talking about a lot of far flung spaces and sets. You know, there was a really sense of almost claustrophobia to the horror movies this year.
Yeah.
And this one's really not different, but it had the feel, again, it brought to mind that like Tales from the Crypt or Twilight Zone kind of feel. It's not, it doesn't have the texture of a novel, but it doesn't need that texture. I mean, it's just so out that it's legitimately scary too. I mean,
oh yeah, that's really creepy moments.
For a supernatural thriller, it really delivers, I thought.
I felt it was a nice mystery too, trying to figure out exactly what kind of
I was legitimately
happened.
Compelled
was like,
by that.
What
I
is going
to
on
know.
With this thing? Yeah. And so yeah, it was a really good story. I thought it was really, really well done. I was actually very I was kinda like not really sure if I wanted to see this. But once we started into it, I was like, this is actually okay, this seems pretty good.
It had all the earmarks and of trouble to it,
it
I
did.
Thought. And
it
then
did.
it evaded every single one of those. And it gave you something surprising.
Let's just say I've seen Dead Girl and I was afraid I was gonna see that again. Thankfully this was nothing like that at all.
And I would say this, I think this is fair. You can be a kind of mild to mainstream horror fan and enjoy this movie.
Oh,
this
yeah, easily.
This is not... There are some strong scenes, but this isn't like full tilt gore. This is more creepy, spooky, ghost story atmosphere.
And very scientific in its approach toward the autopsy. I mean,
yeah,
it's not
the
like
autopsy
they're...
part is not that troublesome.
Yeah, exactly. As a matter of fact, Jen didn't seem to have a problem. She kind of watched half of it with us.
It's a good, it's a good story. You know what? It feels like it could almost be outside of his Cthulhu mythos. This has the feels of an H.P. Lovecraft short
totally,
story.
Totally, yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so moving on now. Number four. I had on my list, this is the guy I was mentioning earlier, is probably not as exciting as some of the newer filmmakers, but James Wan's The Conjuring 2. I really, really enjoyed this because, I enjoyed the first Conjuring, but I think they really expanded on that with this one. I felt that they fleshed out the relationship between the two main characters as the Warrens a lot better. I felt like they used their love in a way almost to like kind of defeat the evil. Like they, it was...
Their relationship felt realistic, yeah.
Yeah, I felt like it was much more powerful in this one than the first one, but they also had some really great creepy moments. So this is based on the case of the haunting at Enfield, and you can say what you will about the Warrens. I personally don't necessarily believe that they've fought anything evil in real life, but it's based
I feel
on
they're probably shysters, but the movie doesn't need that. The movies,
no, this, as
movie
a story
Warrens are
is
great
fantastic.
Characters. I would watch like five more movies with them in it.
Absolutely. And so the movie starts off, they go into, they kind of give you the backstory a little bit of the family in this house that's haunted. They don't know what's really going on. There's a little girl who kind of sees some things and is experiencing some supernatural elements. And they just get more and more intense and terrifying as the movie goes. And they did some really creepy stuff with this one that I wasn't expecting. I think one of the scenes that was one of my favorites was when they try to talk to the entity and they fill the girl's mouth with water so that they can, you know, if she talks, they'll know it's maybe not a hoax. and then they actually have a conversation with the entity. I thought that was a pretty creepy moment. And they just had, I think that James Wan has kind of grown a little bit as a filmmaker.
Yeah, no doubt.
This actually shows some savvy with like, some of the shots and the way that it's constructed. I'm not a huge fan of some of his other stuff. I was glad to see in this one they didn't really have any references to Saw, thankfully. Because even in The Conjuring, I think they had a nice little spiral in that little like music box or whatever. But yeah, I really enjoyed The Conjuring 2. I thought it had a great story. I thought it had a lot of great scary moments. It developed... there was a great scene with Vera Farmiga where she's getting these sensation that there's some evil force in her house, and she goes into a room filled with paintings. And I don't want to go into spoiler territory, but that was one of the most effective like use of shadows I've seen in a movie in a while. I really enjoyed it. What were your feelings on this one, Nathan?
So, the first Conjuring, got so intense with the jump scares. I really liked it too, just as a fun haunted house ride. Mm-hmm. And I agree, Juan's definitely matured as a filmmaker. When I say matured, it's not like he's decided, oh, I'm going to make serious films. I don't think, obviously not that at all.
Yeah.
But what he does, he takes the haunted house as fun house mentality, and he pushes it just about as far as it could go. At least that's what I thought when I saw The Conjuring. The Conjuring 2 pushes it even further to the point where we're looking at almost a two-hour movie that is almost wall-to-wall, and quite literally, with jump scares, with things popping out of every single angle. And almost exclusively, universally, with the exception of a couple of movies, Poltergeist, the original being one of them, you very rarely get away with that with me, because you usually exhaust me at some point. You get to a point where the movie is just so overwhelmed that I've checked out of it. What helps in this movie is what you've mentioned with the Warrens. We believe their relationship to one another. We believe their desire to help other people and to fight evil. Mm-hmm. And the setting is great. The 70s settings are really working for this series of movies. Mm-hmm. And you could see how much confidence they have in this movie, because they drop the Amityville thing right in the beginning in a cold open, and then they never go back to it.
Yeah.
And they just jump into this other story, this Enfield haunting. It's just a lot of fun. It doesn't quite make my list. It was just the other side. It would fall in the honorable mentions. But this is a movie that I think is better than the original.
I think the reason I have it up so high is that this movie, you know, being fourth on the top 10, is because it actually has a lot of heart to it.
It does just what you want it to do.
Even one of my favorite things, and I am not a softy by any means, but one of my favorite scenes is when Ed pops out the guitar and starts singing to like the kids and his wife.
Well, so good and so unexpected in that moment. And that's what is good about this movie. It doesn't just blindside you with the horror, it blindsides you with the heart elements too. But those scenes you mentioned, like with the water and everything like that, like those kind of took me back to old 70s thrillers like Audrey Rose and things of that nature, or The Omen, where you had that very scientific approach to the supernatural, where people really wanted to believe. And so, you know, the supernatural scientists were out in force in that period of time, and the movie captures that really well. Yeah, this is a totally fun but creepy movie. And, you know, people are talking about these different franchises. We have these franchises, and we keep turning out movies, and we don't know why. This is one of a handful of franchises. I'm legitimately excited every time to see what they're going to do next. Now, that excludes the Annabelle movies, because...
Well, yeah. I mean...
With the Warrens, I could keep watching movies based on their cases if we continue with this same approach, if Juan continues to build this world because this was really good stuff.
Yeah. And one last thing about I was actually a little bit more impressed with it, because there was a spirit in the movie that pops out at one point that's like really freaky, and I thought to myself, this looks entirely made out of CGI, and it actually turned out to be a guy in a suit, and I was like, wow, that's actually really cool.
Was that the creepy man in the...
Yeah.
Yes. Wow.
I was like, that was impressive that they pulled that off.
That's that's fun stuff.
What about you, Nathan? What you got on
board? So speaking of fun, because, you know, what's drawn me to horror over the years is that sense that I can have fun with it. Because while I'm mentioning some of these movies I really appreciate, like Green Room, I appreciate the dread it induces in me. But I'll be honest, I'm not having fun, really. Yeah. You know, there's an element where I want to go on this ride. But to me, the horror movies that probably work the best, and this is just my own preference, are those movies that I'm excited, I'm elated, I'm in this. And to do that, you kind of do have to balance the darkness with, I want to see my fellow man doing the right thing and kind of looking out, you know, looking out for the little guy. The one element that makes The Conjuring so good, but at the same time, give me a really... really imposing threat. Give me something that just thrills me, that puts me on the edge of my seat. So one of the movies that did this better than anything I saw this year, and I just saw it recently, was Sang Ho-yoon's Train to Busan.
I've heard nothing but good things about this
one. I've lost a lot of interest in zombie movies over the year. I think because zombies have become such a blasé threat.
It has.
You can't really do a zombie movie if your movie is focused on the zombies and have it be good. I mean, I think that all the way back to Night of the Living Dead, that was true. And that's doubly true now, where they've become blasé. Even, you know, people like The Walking Dead, not because of The Walking Dead.
Exactly.
We like Shaun of the Dead, not because of the zombies. And Train to Busan's not really any different. But this is a fantastic South Korean film. Starts with you've got the workaholic father, which is one of my least favorite tropes in the history of movies. The dad who doesn't have time for his little girl. But this is handled well. And it becomes the basis for a character arc where his daughter wants to go to Busan to see her mother for her birthday. And he kind of reluctantly puts work aside to take her. And he works for a biotech firm. And he's just, I'm going to put this aside. And he gets on this train. And then, no surprise, the zombie virus begins percolating on the train. And this...
Oh, yeah.
This escalates quickly. It gets real, real quick. And the movie keeps up with the virus. The virus, these are legitimate zombies, meaning that the infected do die before they become zombies. But they get infected, they die, and they're the fast-moving type. But the way it's filmed, this is very similar, and not unlike the approach to World War Z, though I think this is a much better movie, but those fast-moving kind of flood of humanity.
Okay.
But Train to Busan does so many more interesting things with that flood of humanity because it's on a train and you can only get away in so many ways. But they add a couple of their own elements to the zombie mythos or the rule book, so to speak. And
sort of make it their own.
Yeah, we don't get a lot of explanation. We get a basic explanation for what's happened that ties into the characters. But we have this microcosm of humanity where you do get to see people legitimately being good human beings and trying to look out for each other. And you have some that don't do that. And you have the cowardly, you know, kind of rich guy. That's also kind of a cliche. I don't think that cliche is going away anytime soon. But the way that this movie works, it's just so relentless. It just barrels through, just like the train that it's on. Great action scenes. The budget's a little low, so not every, you know, there's some scenes where, hey, I can see that's clearly CGI, but it's scary, it's action-packed, it's heartfelt at points, it's poignant. And this is a two-hour film. I mean, zombie movies are usually in and out, and they don't wear out their welcome.
Yeah.
And I was never bored for a second in this. And I was always right there in the action. You'll like the characters, you will like the zombies, and you'll like the train and what they do with the train. There's a crazy scene towards the end. I can't even begin to explain. It'll ruin some of the fun. This is on Amazon. I think you can rent it for $4 or $5. You can buy it for about $15. I say it's even worth the buy. This is a good movie.
Sounds like a blast, because I do enjoy a good zombie film. And there are not many good zombie films these
days. It surprises me a little that the movie's as high as it is on my list, but it's worth it. It deserves to be there.
Well, that's awesome. Well, speaking of Korean movies, I'm going to move on to number three, and this is one that you introduced me to, The Wailing, which is now on Netflix.
Wow. Yeah.
This is a crazy, crazy movie. I don't even know how to really get into this one, because I don't want to spoil things. You kind of just have to watch it unfold, because of all the weird stuff that's happening.
It's almost better you could give a quick, list, almost. Like, this has elements of a serial killer movie?
Ghost movie,
infection movie, possession demons, zombies, shamans.
It's crazy, and it's. I love it all because Korean films tend to have this goofy sense of humor to it, almost a little bit.
Go from being really dark, grim, like Silence of the Lambs or Seven, and they'll turn around and be Keystone Cops, cops falling in blood and on their butts. It doesn't happen in The Wailing, but
this has that sort of element to it, but it's not over the top, and I think it's essential because this movie is so overwhelmingly dark at times that it really...
Pitch black.
And it also really grounds the relationship of the father and the daughter. I think that really develops the characters a lot more by having a little bit of humor injected in it from time to time, because it really does go down a dark, dark road, and...
It's overwhelming. It's overwhelmingly emotional, honestly. You get into a movie, people talked about the experiences and the kind of feel of what it's like to see The Exorcist for the first time. There was some of that in my viewing experience of this movie.
Absolutely.
It just was so, the feeling of evil that they present
the malice.
In this movie. The malice contrasted against the human elements of the characters. These people just lost in this dark sort of conspiratorial fog, if you will, because you're trying to figure out, it's another mystery movie, you're legitimately invested in the mystery. It took me two viewings just to even source out exactly what was happening. I couldn't walk away from you and give an exact thing of okay, here are the good guys, here are the bad guys, completely, at least not in the first viewing, but you don't need that exactly. You don't need to fully understand the every gist of the film to appreciate it. Because it's like a sucker punch in a way.
The thing about this that I liked a lot was we're talking almost, it's over 2.5 hours long.
So it doesn't feel like that at all.
It doesn't feel like it at all. That's what I was trying to get at. You know, you talk about slow burn horror movies, and I love a good slow burn. This didn't feel like a slow burn horror movie, and it's 2.5 hours long.
This is your money's worth right
here. Yes. If you have a subscription to Netflix and you haven't seen The Wailing, what are you waiting for? This is fantastic.
Just turn this off and go watch The Wailing.
Basically.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on this one. This is a tremendous movie.
It was a treat. I really enjoyed watching it.
It's at the very tip-top of... the same director did a movie called The Chaser, which I... held as a long time as the kind of standard for serial killer movies. Just a great movie that did combine humor, combined real extreme kind of darkness, action, and humanity. All those things are in The Wailing. It's a wild ride. You may not like where you ultimately end up, but it's very good.
Yeah, and also much like Under the Shadow and, you know, a lot of the foreign films, this one also kind of even now grabs me as like it's just a different, unique perspective in the world because like. Some of the stuff I'm watching, like, people still live like this.
This scene involving the shaman is one of the craziest things I've seen all year. Like, just
hands down.
Yeah. It's that kind of thing you want to stop, find somebody, and bring them into the room
like, look at
and
this.
Say, look at what's happening on screen, because I'm not... I want to make sure you're seeing this.
Yeah.
But this is a really good movie.
Definitely worth watching. What about you? What's your number three?
So, my number three is one we already talked about. They Look Like People. Agree completely with you. To me, this one is so high because it like I said before, it centers right into the things that are my anxieties and my insecurities. And it's almost cathartic to watch it play out in that way. Mm-hmm. Great movie. It's on Netflix. Go see it. Your number two, Chris?
This is also one you previously mentioned. The Autopsy of Jane Doe. I really had a good time with that movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. It was a great mystery. It was scary. Great performances. So I really enjoyed it. I thought that was definitely worth a number two spot.
You know, I think we're going to be able to get through the rest of this pretty quickly because my number two is The Wailing. So really, the question becomes at this point, you know, I think...
What was so freaking good last year that both of us would agree on?
Yeah, and I think if you're a horror fan and you're keeping track of our list here, we probably... I don't think we're that surprising. We're probably not off for most other lists what our number one is. I'll defend that because I'm assuming that you and I have the same number one based on the fact that I saw this movie with you. I know that you loved it, and it would have absolutely been on here somewhere. What I will say before we mention this, I think this isn't so much a case of, oh, everyone thinks this movie's great, that's why it's here. I mean, I legitimately think that this is the best horror movie of the year. I think that this movie is on so many lists. This movie is where it is because of how good it is. Of just like, to me, this
quality.
Is such a... We don't get movies in the genre like this very often. I mentioned movies like The Exorcist and things like that. You don't usually get a movie like this that transcends the genre, but also really embraces it.
Yep.
So, Chris, I'm going to let you say it because I'm pretty certain. Now, you could completely throw me for a loop and say number one movie of the year was The Boy, but I don't think you're going to do that.
Nathan, you cut me to the quick.
What is it?
Of course it's going to be Robert Eggers' The Witch.
Yes, Witch.
So, such the best thing I've seen hands down the past, probably out of genre films, probably the past 4 or 5 years. Really, if I think about it, this is like one of my favorite movies I've seen in a very long time.
Yeah, and I saw this at a film festival about 4 or 5 months before it even released in theaters last spring, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And then I saw it for the second time. I think I saw it with you the second time. Mm-hmm. And it's a movie that it's so unique in how it's done and in what it does that it's really like it transports you. It's like a vehicle into a completely different pane of reality.
Absolutely.
It's called, I think the, you know, it's a New England folktale is the like paraphrase.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Witch, a New England folktale. And that is not wrong at all. I mean,
No. It
is really trying to get into the head of what a Puritan mind would have been afraid of.
I will say this. The reason probably why it resonates so strongly with me is, I mean, I believe a year before I saw this, I went up with some friends, maybe 2 years before this, and we went up to Salem, Massachusetts, and we walked around, and I had never been there before, and I always wanted to kind of check it out up at Salem, see what it was like, see the, you know, museums and stuff. And that was a really cool experience. Everything in this movie matched up with, like, all the historical information we were given. Like, just watching it, just the way that the buildings were constructed, the way the people talked. Like, there was, they would have, like, various little signs here and there in the museums about little pieces of people's diaries where they talked about things during those days. And it just felt exactly like it had come off the pages of those diaries, the script from this movie. Like, it just feels so authentic that it really is a true New England fairy tale or folk tale. I absolutely adored it for the reason of its pure authenticity on that level.
And I think it's safe for me to say, yes, my number one is The Witch as well. And it's not very often, I think, where you get such, not just attention to detail, but to research and recreation of not just a time period, because we've seen that done. We've seen that done with incredible skill time and time again in tons of different movies. To me, a very underrated movie is the 96 version of The Crucible. That captured that time period in very authentic detail as well. But it's not the recreation of a time period. It's the recreation of not just a mindset, but a
mindset,
spiritual, even like identity. The way that these people behaved and thought. And of course, the kernel there in the, at the heart of The Witch is that we may not be as far away from this as we think we are.
Exactly.
And this movie has people who believe there's witches in the woods. And what's even better is there are witches in the woods in this reality. Yeah. This is showing you what that cultivated mindset looks like. But what I thought was really interesting, and this is kind of where I step out and you come from this perspective of, if you're looking at this from a spiritual perspective, there are a lot of people, I think, that were kind of disturbed by this. Oh, it's a movie that deals with the devil, and it deals with all these dark things, and it's very sinister. And we know we had the Satanic Church sort of endorse it or something, which is a little silly. But what I think this movie is really about is the danger that we have when we become so obsessed with, what I say, with sin, with failure, with this idea that we're so obsessed with evil that we completely fail to see goodness, we fail to see grace, and when there's a demon behind every corner, these people are almost, we see their pride and their vanity twist their faith pretty early on. And they're just left in the wilderness, abandoned to evil.
They're so close to it that they're blind to it. It's crazy.
And it's so difficult to watch some of these scenes where they've lost any sense of concepts of grace and mercy and the things that really are kind of the foundation of their religion. They're so caught up in their piety and they're so caught up in their, and this is no commentary, I mean, this is what's happening in the film, the very beginning.
Really,
these people separate themselves from a community because they think their beliefs are, you know, they think their beliefs are somehow higher or above the rest of them. So they relocate themselves out into the middle of the wilderness and they are kind of handed over in a sense to these dark forces. Just purely as a horror film, that, to be fair, these characters didn't stand much of a chance because of the things that, you know, Eggers throws at them. But this is, all the acting in this is fantastic.
Yes.
And the lead actress, she's so good. And it is it's a movie about evil. And in that way, I think it has real things to say about evil, both mundane evil, but supernatural evil, about whatever kind of evil you want to talk about. But it's legitimately creepy and scary, and it's a very strong movie. It's not exploitative in any way. It's not particularly explicit in its imagery, but it is in its ideas and in some of its visuals. I just can't think of a movie that I've ever really seen that's quite like it. There's a real sense of unease.
Unease, yeah.
And you don't really enjoy this movie, even though so much of it is beautiful to look at and experience. There is a sense of what it's like when you get lost in the woods and you can't find your way out and you're going further and further in. The further you go, the more lost you are. And that's true of these characters, both physically, spatially, and then emotionally and spiritually. But you kind of feel that as you're going through the movie. I mean, you feel the shadows closing in and you get to a certain point where you're like, yo, what's next? And that's what I love about a horror movie, like there are scenes there. By the time you get to the end of this, it's wrapped up in this shell, and you really feel like you've seen something that's frightening, but very thought-provoking. And it's not the movie I thought it was. I mean, and I had two viewings to kind of get that together, you know, in a sense. It is not jump scares. It's not. It's a very thoughtful, very patient, very subtle in some ways movie. I mean, this is a movie that makes a goat one of the scariest things you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
And the goat has been a major talking point of everyone who's seen it, some people who haven't seen the movie. In retrospect, the goat never does as much as you think it does. What happens in this movie is a lot of it's left up to the imagination. And that's where this thing burrows in and sits. And I think that's what makes it so effective.
Yeah, and that is the mindset of the time. That's what I really liked about it, that it does that. It's all about where you think.
And it doesn't shy away from that, from the evil and the destruction.
Yeah.
And that makes it pretty compelling, too, I think.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things. I really loved that movie.
Yeah, so, I mean, to me, it's going to be hard to beat that film this year. And I don't even know that should be the goal, because we very rarely get a movie that good. But I'd say my top 10, every one of these is, in the genre, is a must-see.
Yeah.
And honorable mentions, I think we hit a lot of them. I mean, I'd say The Conjuring 2, very good movie. Lights Out was good. There's a great, maybe too much of a word. There's a really good movie that's on Netflix called Hush, which is a...
Oh, I didn't get to see that. I was going to
watch
it.
Yeah, yeah. I'd recommend it. It's very simple. We go back to the simple premise. You have a deaf woman in a house, and there's a killer outside the house, and he's kind of stalking around the neighborhood. And it's very effective. It has that kind of mentality that you would associate with something like Halloween, the original Halloween. And I liked it a lot. And this movie, and Hush is from director Mike Flanagan, who's had a pretty busy couple of years, but he had three movies released this year. One of them, Before I Wake. And actually, I don't know if they've actually... They were going to release it. They screened it. Then they pulled it back, and I don't know if they've ever released it. So Before I Wake, Thomas Jane's in it. It's a pretty... got a cool premise. It's a movie where you have a supernaturally inclined child and dreams coming to life and stuff like that. I don't know how completely effective it is. He also... He had done two movies before, Absentia and Oculus. I really liked Absentia. Oculus, I wasn't as taken with.
Oculus had potential, but it didn't ultimately deliver. I thought it was disappointing.
Yeah. And he also did Ouija, Origin of Evil, which is a sequel to a movie nobody wanted. And yet I've heard good things about Ouija, Origin of Evil. I haven't gotten a chance to see it yet. I'm almost
afraid to rent it.
I've heard good things. And if Hush is any indication, this is a well-done horror movie. This is a movie that understands all those things we talked about, the atmosphere, the need for character, but there's the vulnerability aspect with the deaf woman, but she is not a victim. Again, this becomes a cat and mouse game. She's got, you know, one point against her to begin with, because here's the killer, he's watching her from the outside, she can't hear him, but it's watching her try to navigate that additional element. Much like Don't Breathe, you know, flips the script. The blind guy has the advantage on them because he knows his house and he knows the dark, and they don't. And the characters have to get around that. And that's what makes this movie pretty good. It allows you to sympathize with her and yet be... The killer element is scary. Flanagan, I believe, has been tapped to do the latest reboot of Halloween. Or maybe, I don't know if it's a reboot or a sequel, but I think he...
If they don't remake Halloween 3, I'll be disappointed.
much more so than Rob Zombie. I think he has a better handle on the spirit of what made the Carpenter movie work, the first.
Nice.
So I think Flanagan is a good choice for that. If they have to do it, he's a good choice. I'd rather see him do original work.
Yeah.
So Hush was for me. I'm sure there are others that aren't coming to mind right now. It was a pretty good year.
Yeah, like I said, probably Under the Shadows would be my honorable mention. I like 10 Cloverfield Lane as well. That would be another honorable mention. Then We Are What We Become on Netflix.
Yeah, We Are What We Become.
Say Swedish
or What We Become.
What We Become. Like zombie film.
Yeah, another sort of like
this one's a little different though, because it's more about what happens when everyone becomes kind of quarantined and they realize they're going to have to start really defending and fending,
which are some of the most interesting aspects of the movie. I think it's that element.
Yeah, there it's was not. It's also a very slow burn movie. It's not a lot of Like, if you're looking for a good zombie movie, you know, I wouldn't go for that, per se. But I think it has some interesting ideas.
Mindy Keating's Darling was an interesting movie.
Yes, that was also kind of
horror film. There were definitely some misses this year. And we're kind of, we've gone all low on time, but I think it would be worthwhile to mention maybe just a couple of the worst horror movies year, because it was a great
they
year.
They are immediately at top of mind when you say a couple.
Let's hear it, Chris.
The worst stinking things I've seen this year, The Boy. That was miserable.
I dodged a bullet on that, but I did see The Forest. Also came out earlier this time of year. Another movie, great premise, great idea that this girl loses her sister in this Japanese suicide forest. Like, nice. That's a good premise. Like, you got the one out of three.
Premise.
But almost everything from there is downhill. And the ultimate twist of this movie kind of just unravels the whole thing. Just right away. And I hear the same thing is true of The Boy.
It is. It is exactly the same thing. That one's where we had a governess come into a house for an old couple. They say, we've got a special boy here. We need you to take care of him. We're going on vacation.
And he's a doll.
And it turns out he's a doll. So, you know, they tell her, oh, yeah, you know, you need to feed him and set out his food and clean him and all this kind of stuff and talk to him.
Dumb premise.
And, you know, then, of course, it goes, I won't even say twist because this is like zero in the creativity level. We've seen this 100 times in horror movies. Don't waste your time, even if you're a big car fan.
We have Don't Breathe, waste your time. That kind of sums up, I believe, sort of The Forest as well. What else you got?
So we say a couple. I got one more to make two. Shut In. That was god-awful. That was a movie where
I dodged a bullet on that one. I did not see that either.
I'm a Naomi Watts fan, and I barely could make it through this thing. Again, a very uncreative movie. It was about a woman and her husband and boy die, her husband dies in a car accident. Her boy turns into quadriplegic, and so he's in his bed all day long, and she takes care for him by herself. During the day, she runs like a psychology, she's a child psychologist. And she kind of handles cases for the state and stuff. And she's dealing with this one boy who's going into different foster homes and things. And he disappears at one point. I don't want to get too much into it because the plot, whatever is there, is kind of threadbare. But she eventually thinks he's living in the house with her as a ghost. Like, she thinks he's died and he's living there. But no, that's not the dumb twist. If you've ever wanted to see PG-13 Naomi Watts nudity while vomiting into a toilet, watch this movie.
She's vomiting in the toilet, or you were vomiting into the toilet?
No, I was just wishing I wasn't in the
toilet. Yeah.
That was lousy.
On the bigger budget movie end, another one that comes to my mind was a summer film that I just recently caught up with, and I wish I hadn't bothered, called The Darkness. Kevin Bacon.
Oh, you're right. I did see that, too. Oh.
Native American evil spirits. A colossal
that
would have
been
power.
A great idea, though. Like, I would love to see a good Native American spirits movie.
But that, here's an example. So we talked about these movies: Demon, Under the Shadow, The Wailing.
Unique cultural experiences.
But you know, it's funny because we have seen a couple movies involving Dybbuk, The Possession, and I think The Unborn. Mm-hmm. They're both not good because they had to take this mythology that's interesting and compelling, morph it into this American horror experience. Yeah. That's what The Darkness does. That's what The Forest did, and it just kind of ruins it at that level. And The Darkness, to me, was your typical jump scares. There was almost no coherence to what was happening. It was a waste of actors, a waste of writing. Mm-hmm. It was just another movie that, to me, was a big disappointment, called The Other Side of the Door. That deals with this kind of... Did you see that one?
I did not.
Has a great, great concept. Great sort of setting where you're now kind of in India and you have these dark Indian death spirits. Mm-hmm. But we fall back on fake jump scares. We fall back on bad, shaky camera style movements and things like that. Another one on top of my head was not doing so hot these days with anthology movies.
Oh, God.
Anthology horror. I'm finding anthology horror...
How could a genre that started off so good turn so bad so quickly?
So we had this year, we had Holidays, which the bright idea here was, and it was a good idea, we're going to give every director a different holiday and let them make a movie. What's strange is half of these holidays, they don't relate... The story relates almost in no way except tangentially to the holiday. So we have Easter. Easter's weird. I don't even get into Easter. It's very off-putting. But there's Father's Day. Well, there's not much going on that relates to Father's Day. The one for St. Patrick's
Day. Didn't they already have sort of like that kind of a like Father's Day kind of themed horror series called The Stepfather or something? Like, well, it may not be necessarily Father's Day, but it's kind of got that.
The Father's Day short is honestly the best one in the entire film. But and it has Jocelyn Donahue from House of the Devil.
Nice.
But even there, it still kind of drops the ball. There's not a single short in here that delivers what it kind of promises. Mm-hmm. It's just, I'm short films, they're a very dicey kind of proposition. You have to get in there, you have to make it count. Mm-hmm. And just a lot of lazy work. There's a segment in here from Kevin Smith, which is, for him, to be one of the laziest things he's ever done, that's a bit of an achievement these days. Which, when I also say, Yoga Hosers is at the very bottom, the absolute, like, here's the dreck. And then at the very bottom is Yoga Hosers. Worst thing I saw all year. I wish I had just stabbed myself in the hand with a pencil and run into the other room screaming and bleeding so I didn't have to finish it. And I didn't have to finish it. I don't know why I finished it. Terrible, terrible movie. When we're on anthologies, you and I just watched Siren, which is the feature-length version of David Bruckner's opening segment of VHS. It wasn't my favorite segment of that series. Decent. But what they've done here feels like you feel almost weird. I'm like, I feel like I'm some kid trying to sneak Cinemax at like 10 p.m. That's on a exactly Friday. What it feels like. And I remember there was a point where I'm just like, look over you, can we turn this off yet? It's completely juvenile. Feels like How I Met Your Mother or something crossed with, like I said, a bad Cinemax late night thriller. The female actress who played the creature in the short is back.
If you're making a movie just solely on a creature, The special effects for the creature in the short were actually halfway decent. In this, they're just comically bad looking. They just look goofy.
Yeah.
That's really all this movie has to go for it, is that aspect of like, oh, we've got a creature that can flap around and chop you up with her claws and
it
stuff.
It's and a lot of it just stole
the rest of it is garbage.
From Jeepers Creepers, from all these other horror movies. Not necessarily even good horror movies, but it just a bankruptcy of imagination, if you will.
Speaking of bankruptcy of imagination, when clearly a lot of talent and time and effort was put into it, Eyes of My Mother, I was very disappointed by.
And see, I didn't see that. I'm glad you mentioned it, though, because that's a movie that is actually getting some, in some circles, some love from the horror
community. A lot of love.
I mean, I think most of the stuff we've mentioned are obviously rotten apples, you know?
I feel like this is mostly because it's based on my preference, and I think you'd agree with me because you're not as much into this kind of subgenre of, like, a torture element or, like, case studies of psychologically damaged people for horror movies as much.
I don't mind a case study of psychologically damaged people, but just some form of visceral ripping and tearing and rending that either is nauseatingly handled or is handled in this sort of pompous, I'm too good for this way, where look how artistic we are. We're going to lift ourselves above it.
This didn't have as, like, for what it does in the movie, that kind of element could easily be there, and it wasn't, like, super over the top with the ripping and the tearing and all that kind of stuff. It was there. It was just that
this one struck me, it might be more the latter, the one where it's like we're so removed from it in this austere, artistic way that it just becomes empty.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, there were things that I liked about it. I'm not going to say I hated this movie, but the story behind it was very minimal. Very minimal. It just didn't interest me as a story. I'll give you that. It had some good black. I love the black and white cinematography. I thought that was gorgeous. But ultimately, when you're boiling down to like kind of a torture movie, I didn't much care for it. I'm not a huge torture kind of guy, and it wasn't. That wasn't the only thing happening in the movie. There was other stuff going on, clearly. But there was so little other stuff going on. Like, just, I don't know. Like, I like the idea behind it, but they didn't execute it very well to me. I was just kind of disappointed. I was hoping for something great because I was seeing a lot of good reviews on it, too.
Well, and, you know, for all the good we did get, you know, you take the good with the bad. There wasn't as much bad as there was. Another one I'll add that I've heard good things, people saying good things about that I personally had very little use for was the movie Clown. Came out over the summer.
That's the kind of movie I would love. You would think
I was, that I would enjoy. Yeah, you know what? I remember watching it with you and being like, you know, you want the litmus test. Chris did not enjoy this movie about a
demonic clown. It's about an evil clown eating children. What's not to love?
The movie even sets up a concept that is compelling, which is the basic sense of this film should almost be a tragedy, even though it's got this humorous idea of this guy putting on a clown costume he can't take off, because he does it to be a good father. He's trying to be a good dad, and it goes horribly wrong for him. But the movie doesn't sell that to you. It doesn't sell the emotional element, so it all comes out completely. It's too grim to really be silly and fun. And
which it's too silly, has to be, it's not going to work.
It's too silly to be taken seriously. So you end up in this weird middle zone. It reminded me of what they, like, maybe because Peter Stormare was in that movie and also the one I'm about to mention, reminded me of, like, the Bad Milo movie they did a few years back. Except Bad Milo, this guy who had a rage monster living in his butt, and it would emerge and murder people. I legitimately enjoyed that movie, but it knew how to play the line between absurdity and pathos, and Clown did not. Clown was a train wreck. So that's 2016 for us. We are looking forward to 2017. We're going to be bringing you much more regular podcasts, regroup and kind of describe and kind of let everyone know what we're going to what our goal is this year, what we're heading towards in terms of content and ideas and things like that. Just give you a little bit of a teaser for what's ahead and in store with the podcast. So have a great evening, everyone, and hope you enjoy the list. We will see you soon. Take care. We hope you enjoyed tonight's cast, and we hope that you'll join us again when Phantom Galaxy returns with a brand new episode. If you wish to contact us, you can email us at phantomcasts@gmail.com. We're also available. You can find us on phantomgalaxy.podbean.com. And our episodes are also going up over at popcultureninja.podbean.com. All of the music in tonight's episode comes from Lithuanian artist Stellar Drone, whose ambient electronica creates soundscapes that are both haunting and fascinating to listen to. Stellar Drone's music is actually available for free on the internet in a couple of different places. You can find his Facebook page under Stellar Drone on Facebook, and you can also find all of his albums available on stellardrone.bandcamp.com. Until next time, this is Nathan Parabol with the Phantom Galaxy.